I am Kenneth Nichols, and here we are with the Great Writers Guild podcast. Today, we're going to hear from a very cool poet, Rosalind Vaz Diaz, the author of Only Blue Body from Anhinga Press. I'm going to go check that out. We had a great talk about poetry, about why we do what we do, how to revise, how to have mentors, even a little bit about how to entertain your audience when you're at a reading. Ms. Vaz Diaz made a little bit of Great Writers Guild history. She's the first poet with whom I have spoken on this podcast. So go ahead, pour yourself a color teeny, sit back, and listen to the great advice that you'll hear from her. All that and more coming up right after this. My talk with Ms. Vaz Diaz was actually a pretty interesting one for me because, like we all do, I'm kind of going through a bit of self-doubt at the moment for a number of reasons. Ms. Vaz Diaz and I spoke about the fears that we all share as writers. How do we overcome the self-doubt that is part and parcel of being a creative person? How do we do that? And I think one of the ways is through community. And that's why I wanted to give a shout-out to penbuzz.com. That's penbuzz.com. Now, it's something a little bit interesting, a little bit different. It's a social media network for writers. It's at the beginning stages, so it's not as hopping as your Facebook feed. But it's definitely worth checking out. One of the interesting things that the creator has done is to make a place where people can ask questions of each other. It's like a social media message board, but without all of the pictures of your friends' babies. I think that's a good way to put it. For example, a writer, Julia Proud, who is a writer of crime fiction, noir, I believe, she asked a question in the open forums about how we create first-person present tense. Ms. Proud writes, "How do you guys feel about first-person present tense? Do you enjoy reading books written in this style? Do you write them? Is it as difficult as it sounds? If you have experience with first-person present tense, then what are the things a writer venturing to use this style should watch out for?" I love that there's a nice, robust discussion of this question. In case you're curious what I thought, I happen to respond to her thus. I point out that it's very much a tool, just like any other point of view or style or technique available to us. I think that first-person point of view is great for suspense or crime stories because it limits the amount of information that the reader has in a natural way. A person who's investigating a crime, by nature, pretty much can't have all of the information that they'll have at the end of the investigation. So it unspools that narrative in a really realistic way. However, third-person, future tense, any kind of tense you want can create a great story of any kind. It's all about how you use it and how you measure the effect that you have on the reader. See the kind of interesting things that you get into at penbuzz.com? So I urge you to go check it out. It's free. It's the kind of thing the creator is trying to get something interesting and fun off the ground. So why not go check that out? That's penbuzz.com. PENBUZZ.com. Yes, I know at first I thought it was a new fountain pen site and I got all excited, but then I found it was something equally cool but different. And speaking of cool but different, let's get right into my interview with Rosalind Vaz Diaz. All right, we are here with Rosalind Vaz Diaz, author of Only Blue Body, a poetry book. It won the 2011 Robert Dana Anhinga Prize for Poetry from Anhinga Press. Hello, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have to say that I really enjoyed your book. I'd like to hear a little bit about your journey in getting the book published and in becoming a poet.
Sure. I guess I'll start with the process and then I'll work backwards to my beginnings as a poet. The book started as my thesis project for the MFA program that I went through, Warren Wilson College. It's a low-res MFA program. So I think when it was finalized as my thesis, it was about 27 pages, I believe. They don't require you to have a book length manuscript completed for your thesis at Warren Wilson. Some MFA programs do, but they're a little bit more flexible with that. So when I left the program in 2006, I knew that I had to get about, I guess to get to book length, maybe it was longer than 27 pages. I can't completely remember because that was, it feels like a
It
long
does,
time
doesn't
ago
it?
now,
Yeah.
which is strange. I knew that I had a decent chunk of work to work with, but it wasn't quite ready to go out the door. And I think I had a somewhat common experience coming out of an MFA program in that I was a little frozen. Like I didn't feel completely comfortable writing anymore in some ways, just writing like in a spontaneous way or a playful way. So it took me a little bit of time. I did a lot of just playing around in my notebook and journaling and kind of trying to write some work. And I was pretty nervous because I felt like I wasn't moving fast enough, like I wasn't getting my thesis out there in the world quickly enough. And then actually, I think in late 2007, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, Ross White. He's another Warren Wilson alum, and he runs Bull City Press, which is run out of North Carolina. And they do the publication Inch, and they've done some chapbooks, I think, and they also sponsor the a competition with Frost Place, a really great little chapbook competition, where they print the chapbook and you also get to spend, I think, a week or two at Frost Place. So that's an interesting little project that they have there now. But he had been doing a poem a day thing with a very small circle of people, and it was brand new at the time. And I expressed some sort of half-hearted interest in that. I was like, oh, that sounds like something I'd like to do. Kind of thinking like, oh, I would love to do that, but I probably never will because it doesn't sound like something I'm capable of. And then the next thing you know, I was signed up for November, and I had to write a poem a day, for November of 2007. And it really worked. It really got me over that hump of fear and procrastination. And then I think by early 2008, I had enough poems to kind of throw together a book-length manuscript with what I had already had and the new work. And then that was the very first draft. And I polished it over the years. So I started submitting it for the first time in spring of 2008 and submitted it for about 3 years. And I think like early 2011, I was like, I am going to get this thing taken this year. And I just sent it to as many contests as I could, and I revised it heavily. I cut, I think, about seven poems and replaced them with new work that I liked a lot more. And then in November of 2011, I got an email from Anhinga asking if it was still available and letting me know that it had won this prize. So that was that little adventure. And then I think we spent about a year just, editing it and putting it together. And it came out in November 2012.
Yeah, no, very cool. I'm shopping around a young adult novel, and I've sent out more queries than I'd like to admit. So it's nice to hear, that you went through this kind of struggle for 3 years on the book. What got you through that time?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, what got me through it, when I started Warren Wilson, I met a poet, an older poet who lives in LA, and his name is Rick Bersky. He actually has his third book coming out. But of course, at the time I met him, both of us had zero books. And we maintained our friendship. And when his first book came out, he told me that he had sent it out about 90, maybe 92 or 96, somewhere in the 90s. So I was like, okay, that's, I have to send it out about 100 times. And then I'm going to worry after 100. So until I hit 100, I'm going to try not to stress out. And I think I didn't keep the best records when I was sending it out that time. I'm sending out a second manuscript now, and I'm trying to keep better records. But I did eventually count it up, and I think I sent it out about 70 times in that 3 year period. So, you know, and the other thing, I guess, is, you know, here and there I would be notified that I had been a finalist, or I would get like a really small encouraging note, and I was like, okay, I'm getting a little closer. And I was working on it, and I was trying to make it better, and I was trying to make it tighter, and I could see it getting better, and I think that helped too. And it is a pretty lonely, it's kind of a lonely process. I didn't have a lot of people that I showed it to. I didn't have a group, a workshop group of any kind that I was showing it to or sharing it with. And I didn't really have any mentors that I was working with on it. But I mean, I kind of already had been through the mentor process with the MFA program. And I think to some extent you have to internalize that for the time after the MFA programs. So maybe that helped as well. And then just to address your other question, you know, I probably started writing, like a lot of poets, I started writing poetry when I was 14, and because, you know, I had some unhappy relationships. And I think that's probably, I don't know, how many poets do you think get started that way?
I think it's a lot. I did that. You know, they're all horrible. They're all thinly veiled allegories of what you went through. They're all like rock song lyrics, or you know, at least in my case, I'm guessing it's very common.
I think it's extremely common. So, but I liked it. And, you know, I also knew my dad was an English teacher, so there were a lot of books around the house, and there were definitely a lot of things that would come home, like writing advice things. And, you know, what I would read is, you know, every writing teacher says that poets have to read poetry. So I started doing that kind of a little bit on my own. So I would go to my library in the high school, and I would check out books of poems, and I would like read my brother's creative writing textbook from when he started taking college classes. And that's it. And it's not like I was reading the most amazing poetry in the world or anything. I was just trying to put it together and to see what was out there. And I just kind of stuck with it. I felt like I could see my work progressing. By the time I was around 18, I was like, okay, well, I can see that my work seems better than it was when I was 14, or better than it was when I was 16. So if I keep going, the stuff I'm writing now, like what I'm going to be writing in 4 or 5 years will be better than what I'm writing right now. And then sometimes I do wonder, like, there are definitely points in my life where I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, I started doing this at a certain age and kind of naively kept doing it. And I think that it's probably kind of important to check in with yourself here and there and say, hey, do I still like this? What does it mean to me now? how do I feel about it? Like, what makes me happy? I think that's just part of what you do.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely in that same place. Because I'm just so I want to get my book published. I'm feeling exactly the way you described, where you know, every few years you kind of say, like, why am I not more successful? Why am I not doing what I want to do? But I guess it's normal.
Yeah, that sounds really, really pretty normal. And to some extent, I am doing what I want to do. I think for me, like, my professional life is probably worse than my writing life. And I think my writing life is sort of what gives my life any value that I can assign it. So, and that might just be something that I tell myself so that I don't feel really depressed, you know, because it's easy to get into a place where you're like, this is meaningless and stupid, and no one cares about me. But that's not really true. You know, the people in my life have been really supportive. You know, the relationship that I'm in right now, my boyfriend's very supportive. My parents have always, always, always been very encouraging, which is shocking and special. You know, I think that when you're a poet and your family's like, yeah, we think you should write poetry, that's really special. And it's not to say that they always get it or understand what the heck I'm doing. But we don't have big fights about it. You know, it's not something that they never say, well, you should give that up now.
Oh, sure.
Isn't it time? So I think I'm fortunate in that way.
What I found interesting through the common thread of the book, and through, I'm guessing, a lot of your current work, because it seems like a very personal common theme, there's a lot of animal imagery in the book. A lot of that kind of thing. Where is that a conscious thing that you're doing, or am I incorrect? Or do you have a relationship with the animal kingdom that gives life to you in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in rural PA, rural Pennsylvania, and I spent a lot of time outdoors, and I think I've always felt, you know, we had a lot of barn cats and animals around, and I think I've always felt a little closer to animals, or they were a presence in my life from early on. I don't feel like I'm addressing this in a very eloquent
way.
No,
it's actually perfect timing, because I hear a dog muttering and shaking its chain, so I find that perfect.
Yeah, he just wanted to put his two cents in. Animals have always been a big part of my life and a big part of my imaginative life. You know, when I was a kid, like I said, I would spend a lot of time outdoors and by myself, and, you know, I would tell myself these elaborate stories, usually involving, like, orphans who could talk to wolves and, you know, control, you know, like, have conversations with animals, and the animals would help them with things. So, and of course, that's a huge thing in fairy tales and children's stories as well. So, I do often feel like I've never really, like, I guess in my ideal world, I would be a character in a children's book.
I like that way of thinking about it, because I'm thinking of at least a couple poems, Hidden and Drawing the Self-Portrait. There's an I character, and the I is at least part animal.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like something that you're imagining for yourself in some kind of connection.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I still kind of think of myself in some ways, and maybe it's even just a kind of a coping mechanism of going through life, you know, of looking at my own behavior and thinking of myself as an animal, and thinking of myself, like, how I move through the world and what I'm reacting to and how I survive. And it can be kind of a fun way to look at one's existence, I think.
Oh, definitely. I wanted to talk about because I haven't actually spoken with a poet yet in these podcasts, so I'm really interested to get inside the head of, a real poet as opposed to me, who's just kind of published, in some cool places. But you're an actual poet, and I wanted to know about one of the big differences, it seems to me, between poetry and prose is obviously the sound of the words on the page mimicking some kind of response. In the mind, the way that you transfer sounds and meaning in a much more scattershot artistic way than you would in prose. And obviously there's no good or bad, it's just a different method of communication. So I was thinking, if you look at a poem like Mosquito in the book on page 16, the lines, I don't see that. I like to write in meter. I'm not seeing that the book is written much in meter. But the lines are 6 or 7 words long. They're separated by double spacing. I'm thinking of the sound that you're trying to create and then comparing it to something that looks a lot more prose-based. For example, that poem Night Work at Jeff's, which seems like a collection of paragraphy type lines. Can you talk at all about the sound that you have in your head when you're constructing lines that are more poetic than prose-based?
Yeah, that's such a tough question. In some ways, because it really gets to the heart of like, why do you choose a more lyric way of expression, as opposed to just sitting down and writing a prose poem? I think, oh man, I love that question. I think for me, some of it is about pacing, and some of it is about control of the situation, and taking time to look at what's, I mean, particularly with this, with Mosquito, and with some of the other poems where what's in front of the speaker is confusing or appalling or terrifying. She's slowing down, she's almost slowing down time and trying to get a handle on what's happening in front of her. So I think that's where the white space and the shorter line might aid in that. And it's, it's been a while. I think I might have written this poem in
Oh, sure.
2005.
It's something that I'm guessing that you still think about as you construct lines.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I don't feel as driven to write in a lyric fashion, and although I still do, and I don't think of myself as being in one box or the other. I love writing really narrative poems. The one of the poems in here, I think, Only Sweetness, which I really have a fun time reading when I read it in front of people. That's a much more narrative poem, but it's also a poem where what's in front of the person who's telling us the poem is not quite clear to her. Like, she's not totally sure what she's seeing, or if what she thinks she's seeing is quite what she's seeing. And that's a much more compact poem, I think. There's not as much white space in it, and the voice is much more narrative. And I think right now, when I'm stuck, when I'm blocked, I like just writing a little prose poem, and writing in the prose line, and just saying as much as I can, and just being like, okay, I'm not gonna give so much significance to to individual bits of sentence. I'm just gonna blurt it. I'm just gonna vomit on the page, basically, and get it out. And I think with the, I probably go back and try to make stuff more lyric now if I do that, and give it more breathing room and give it more white space and cut out unnecessary bits. Some of it might have been the influence of the program. Not that there was an emphasis on lyric poetry, but you could make your own plan for what you were trying to do. And I think what I was trying to do was just actually learn to write poetry in a schooled way. I had been kind of a wild child just by myself. I hadn't really been taught by anyone until I got to the MFA program. So I think there were just a lot of basics that I was missing, and I was trying to learn more about how to control a line, and what that felt like and what it meant. I still love thinking about that stuff. Control in a poem is one of my favorite things to think about ever. And pacing and giving information to the reader and how we do that. It still just lights my brain on fire to think about that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because one of the things that I think about a lot is the way that, especially in poetry, you have a lot of control over the audience's perception of what you're describing and control of their experience. But I'm wondering what you think of as the balance between explaining and not explaining, the balance between being accessible and being experimental. Because I've met a lot of young people, young adults, not 3-year-olds, but they think that poetry is only, fancy pantsy people getting their depressed thoughts out on paper. And like I had someone say that once, and no, it's not necessarily that, and it's not necessarily random letters on a page that someone scratched out of a New York Times article. What do you think about the balance between experimenting and also trying to keep a large audience for poetry?
That's an excellent question, and I'm just going to say before I say anything that I don't know that this book would be ever considered accessible or the most accessible thing that's out there. And I guess I think that's funny in a way. I think the person that I am on the page is not totally like the person I am in life, but a little bit like her. Obviously there's some overlap. It's probably important for young people to, if they're going to be writers, to kind of take the path that they need to take. And I think we all go through that phase of being like, well, this is what poetry is, but it's a huge world. I mean, I think there's so much room to write, whatever kind of poetry you want to write, whether you want to write very narrative poetry or very experimental poetry. I think for me, I want to have fun, and I do want the reader to be engaged and to understand to some extent what I'm saying. I mean, what's the point? We're not trying to baffle the reader. Billy
I was
Collins
just going to
said
mention
something.
that, yeah.
He said something about, I don't know if this is something he said or something one of his teachers said, but if you're going to take me into a dark basement, hold my hand. And then when I was working on my thesis and putting that together at Warren Wilson, I was working with Jim Longenbach, who's a really excellent teacher, and he was all about clarity, and he just wanted me to make my poems as clear as they could possibly be. And I think it's such a blessing. I would wish a teacher like that on any writing student, because it's such a blessing to have a teacher who wants you to write clearly. That probably means something a little bit different, depending on the student. Maybe that just means that you're 20% less obscure than you were when you started. But it's still a huge goal. I mean, of course you don't want to alienate your reader. That's crazy. You want to keep them in the poem until the end of the poem, and you want to keep them in your book until the end of the book, and you want them to hopefully come back to you and read other work that you're going to write. I don't know if that answers that question, but I think clarity is one of the best things for a young writer to learn to have.
Yeah, no, it's a good answer. It's just something that I think about because I worry that some of the obviously there is poetry of all kinds going out there, but I worry that the predominant aesthetic is alienating more of the general audience than it should.
I don't know. That's such
I know
that's
it's a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, I don't even know how to address that. It is a worry. I don't know. I guess I just want to be optimistic, and maybe I want to lie to myself and think that somehow people will come back to poetry. I guess the other thing is, you know, if I'm reading my friend's poetry, I know everyone's like, oh, poets are only reading each other. But that actually means that we have really excellent readers of our work. So, you know, I try to be an ambassador and get people into poetry if I can. And then I just try not to let it keep me awake at night, I guess. Also,
well, I want to talk about that because you mentioned being an ambassador, and you mentioned how some poems, the way you approach them in reading. How do you approach a poem in reading a poem when it's a little bit more like, for example, the title poem "Only Blue Body." It's the way it looks on the page is clearly meaningful, but a lot of that might be lost in the reading because it's verbal. How do you approach performing poems that are less like prose or less linear?
I do try to read the white space a little bit if I can, or try to take a little incremental pause at the end of a line. I think that can be a balancing act. And I just try to also be really engaging when I can be, and to try to be humorous between poems a little bit, because I know that when I'm reading the poems, sometimes I'll be thinking to myself, man, this is weird. Like, what the hell am I doing up here? Like, this is a weird poem. These people are probably freaked out right now. So, that's pretty much all I would say about that. I'm not a big performer. I try to read pretty naturally, and I try to read in a paced way so that the words can be heard and the white space can be at least hinted toward, if not completely heard.
Well, what I love that you're saying is that, obviously, great writers steal. We're trying to steal from you. I love the idea, and I think I've thought of it before, of approaching a reading as kind of like a rock concert, where you begin with, you know, something to get the audience going. There's some nice Bruce Springsteen banner in between songs. And then, you know, you finish with a strong audience, you know, encore performance. Is that a crazy metaphor for you?
No, that's a perfect metaphor because I always know what I'm going to read before I go into the reading. I make a little list of how I'm going to do it. And that's more for me just because I get nervous. So I have to know what page I'm going to next. And I don't want to be standing up there shaking and trying to figure out.
Oh, I forget what page it's on. I think I don't know this one. Yeah. We've all done that. We've seen it.
Yeah, it is a little irksome to go into a reading and have the person be so casual, and you're like, you knew that this reading was happening. Like, are you really going to stand up there and page through your book and try to figure out what you're going to read to us next? Like you didn't even bother to prepare. Like that seems a little bit showy to me, and not real. So I do make sure that there's an arc. Just like putting a manuscript together, I try to give the reading an arc. And I did actually, usually I began with Hidden when I was on my Anhinga-sponsored book tour, because it, I felt like it illuminated, you know, the rest of the reading. And also, that poem is basically a children's exercise. The Kenneth Koch exercise, I used to be, but now I am. That's how I wrote that poem, Hidden, about the Dogoat pirate. So I wanted to say to my audience, you know, hey, I might read you some weird poetry, but this first poem that I'm opening with, it's a children's exercise, and anyone can do it, and you can do it. You can leave here and go write a poem just like this, just using I used to be, but now I am.
If I can ask a small note about that, because how often do we get to ask a poet about his or her work? But in Hidden, you do something in the middle of the poem that I always lecture students not to do, and obviously rules are made to be broken. But I'm really curious about what you think about the sound and the meaning of that also followed by the comma in the middle of the poem. It's several lines down, we got along because it was fiction. Also, there seemed little choice. What was your thought behind also? Do you see what I'm saying? Usually you wouldn't put also at the beginning of a sentence because it's kind of a weak way to get into it. You know what I mean? Like in regular prose. I'm curious about why it works to use it there.
I don't know. I mean, now that you bring that up, who knows if it does work?
Well, I'm not trying to pick on anybody.
I think I wanted the clipped sentence. That sentence, we got along because it was fiction, isn't super clipped, but I wanted to break, you know, I break it with the line break. And I think, I don't totally know why I made that choice. I think there's, the speaker is pointing out that they were existing in a storybook, but they were also in great peril. So in the world of the storybook world, where these animals wouldn't normally get along, even though that's a fictional world, they're still pirates. So they still, if they get captured, they're still going to be punished. I don't think I've ever, like, talked it out like this before, so it sounds even worse. Even sadder in a way, putting it that way.
It sounds great. How often do we hear, you know, a poet thinking about their lines in the fashion that we are?
So, I can't tell you much about the construction. I must have liked, I think maybe I liked the hardness of it. And that's probably all I can say about that, if you know what I mean by heart, like the kind of the hardness,
you know,
of it.
It's a transitional word, and it occurs in the middle of the line after the previous sentence. So I can definitely see how it serves as a transition and lends meaning to what comes after that, which is also broken up by the colon there. So I can definitely see that. I'm just curious, you know, because it's we make a billion choices, especially when we write a poem or lyric poetry or, you know, things that are not prose. And there's, it seems to me, so many more variables than when you're writing regular prose.
Yeah, there are a ton of variables, and we've been talking a lot already about young writers, and I'll just go back and say this. Because I think it's a pretty common way of thinking when you're a beginning poet. You know, you start writing poetry as a kid or as a juvenile, as a teenager, and you think, oh man, this is so much better than writing essays. There aren't any rules.
It's shorter.
I'm just going to do whatever I want. And then if you keep going as a poet, you realize that there are so many rules that they can actually kind of crush you. But by that time, the rules become comforting. And they become somehow better. You know, that you realize how hard it is and how many ways you can screw up. And I guess that just gives you a lot of freedom to kind of keep doing it and keep trying it. And there are so many choices that you have to make, and there probably are places that you're going to make the wrong choice. It's hard for me to think about each. I don't know that I've ever written a poem where each line was exactly perfect as a line. And I know some people who work that way, and I find it pretty astonishing. And if they can do that, I think it's really great. But I don't know if I've ever been that much of a craftsperson that I could do that.
Well, there's plenty of time in the future. That's why we keep doing it.
Yeah, I figure, you know, I have until I die. So I'm not, I'm gonna just keep trying until then.
Well,
right?
that's why writing is so great. You mentioned earlier that, since you're speaking about yourself, that the person on the page is different from you, which is true for every author, but what do you think is the difference between you and the I, or the me in the poems that you create?
Well, the first difference is that my life is so dull, and they get to have these kind of rich adventures where, you know, they could something in front of them could transform into something completely different. And you know, you control, I can kind of edit out the dullness of my life. The person on the page that is still the part of me is definitely a crafted and an edited character. So I guess it's kind of like if you were a color and you were being cooked down into a pigment, or, you know, if you were a harvested pigment and you were being concentrated somehow, that must be a really exciting experience to be the most concentrated form of pigment that you can be. And then I guess you're diluted and made into a painting, but that experience of being compressed into this pure pigment must feel really amazing. And I think that's probably what the difference between the poet who's walking around in real life and the poet who's existing in the poems.
I love that way of thinking about it, because I'm a fountain pen person, and if you can add a couple drops of water to a bottle of ink to make the color a little bit calmer. You can, you know, concentrate it to make sure the colors are a little bit more striking. And so I love that way of thinking about it, because it's the same bottle of ink, but if you take water out or put it in, you get a slightly different hue and slightly different performance in the ink.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I love that. I didn't ask you beforehand. Usually I do, but I'm guessing that you have an indie fun bookstore type place that you'd like to give a shout out to.
Oh, absolutely. There's actually a ton of them in Providence. There's a great one on the west end of Providence, Ada Books, and they run some reading series out of there. There's a series run out of there called Publicly Complex, which is very good if you're in Providence. You can catch some readings there sometimes, and that's a great place to visit. There's a great used bookstore downtown called Seller Stories, which is a really fun, fantastic, jammed with books bookstore. There's another place downtown that sells a lot of academic and art books that are kind of they're not remaindered, but they might be like sort of extras. Maybe they didn't sell that well to begin with, so they're sold at a little bit of a markdown, and you can get some really fabulous critical work and art books and literature there. It's called Symposium Books. So those are three right off the top of my head that you should definitely visit if you're in Providence sometime.
Very cool, very cool. I used to live on Cape Cod, so I would go through Providence.
Yeah, to get to almost anywhere not anywhere in New England.
Lots of
but
places,
Providence is right there on 95. It's a nice little place to visit for the day. Although Cape Cod is Cape Cod's pretty beautiful.
I liked being 5 minutes away from a beach. No matter where you are, you're that close to a beach.
Yeah, it's amazing out there. It's really beautiful.
But Providence is also a nice place. It is because you're so close to water. You're close to Connecticut.
Pretty industrial here. Yeah, actually, we were just down at our public library today. They were having an indie press expo. So there was every kind of person who's ever made a little chapbook or a little comic book or a little print. And it was astonishing. It was so great. Everyone was sitting at their table hawking their wares and like scribbling with their little pens and making cute and funky stuff. And it was a really great day.
I just wish that the world could have more cute and funky indie publishing get-togethers and fewer Kardashians. We need that.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you.
So there are a few questions that I ask everybody, and we're curious because we don't really talk about them very much with other writers. But what does your revision procedure generally look like?
I'm pretty bad at revising. I think because of the same sort of tension that I was talking about earlier. So I kind of got over my tension around just sitting down and drafting stuff. I've gotten over that to some extent. And that fear has kind of moved on to revision. But what I try to do is kind of look, if I'm looking at the poem, at a draft of a poem, I try to figure out, like, what is the most important thing that I'm trying to talk about in this poem? Like, what am I trying to say? Or what matters to me the most? Or did I inadvertently say something in this poem that is the most true part of it? So I think that's the place. You look for that place and you identify it. And then usually what I do is kind of start with a blank page. And I try to kind of rewrite the same poem using that kind of core heartbeat as the jumping off place. Or I write to that place. And what I've been trying to do a little bit lately is if I have an idea and I write one poem about it or to it, and I'm not happy with it, I just rewrite it until I get something better. So I won't necessarily discard the material, you know. So some of it's just trying to figure out what I want to write about or what's most important to me at that moment. And then I just write about that every day until I feel like I have something that I can work with. So although that's not technically revision, it kind of can feel like it because you just kind of pretend you're writing the same poem every day. And then sometimes if that works, you might get more than one decent poem about this thing that you're so preoccupied with. So I think that that's not a bad way to work. You know, because if you fail at something once, that doesn't mean that you've failed at it forever. And, you know, I mean, who goes to run around a track, and if they don't run, you know, the perfect time right away, they just give up? Like, that, we don't do that. So we shouldn't do that with our writing either.
Very cool. When you're working on that, it's obviously maybe a little different from poetry to prose between those people. But how do you compose? I like to use a fountain pen. I don't have special notebooks, but I have ones I like better than others. But how do you generally start putting down lines?
Well, I do actually do just a lot of straight typing right now. But I do use a notebook, and like a ballpoint pen. And I'll just sort of play around with that. And again, it doesn't have to be a special notebook. I try to keep it pretty cheap, 'cause I don't want to be afraid to write in what I have to write in. So I don't want to have something that I feel is too exalted for me to like put my crappy words
No, dollar
into.
store. You can get great journals at the
Yeah.
dollar store.
Exactly. So you just want something that isn't going to make you feel like it's not good, like you're not good enough for it.
It's like when you get a birthday gift. I've gotten you this leather-bound journal full of pages of this beautiful paper.
I know, it's the
Yeah.
scariest thing in the world. You're like, I
I'm not
can't
gonna write
write
in
in
that.
that.
Whereas I've gotten great journals at the dollar store that I've written novels, and I wrote my young adult novel in a dollar notebook that I thought the character might use. Yeah,
Nice. Oh, I love that.
it
I
has
love
that
that.
lenticular cover. It's all purple, and is it flowery? Is it? Oh yeah, butterflies, and it's the kind of thing that I pictured my character writing in. So I wrote the whole book inside that little journal.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Very cool. Once you have poems where you said when you're happy with them, what's your general procedure in terms of submission? What's your philosophy?
My philosophy. I try to submit a lot. And I try to submit, I don't know, like once or I guess what, anywhere from once to four times a year, I'll try to sit down, just with individual poems, and I'll try to do as many packets at a time as I can. So I generally send out three poems together. And if I get out 15 to 25 packets of three poems like once a quarter, or probably once a quarter, that's a pretty good year. Although I guess I don't know if I guess that's an ideal. I'm not sure if I think I generally if I can do 50 packets a year, that's pretty decent. So it's probably more like not every quarter. I just have to keep work out there because I get a ton of rejections. Before the book came out, I was averaging one acceptance a year. So a lot of people will obviously we all talk a lot about do you simultaneously submit or do you not? And I hope no one's actually listening to this because I am going to say that I do simultaneously submit, but that's just because my acceptance rate is so low that I really haven't had to deal with having a poem that two places
Who
want.
doesn't send out simultaneously?
I think it's a necessary evil. I try to get stuff out there, and sometimes I do send stuff out, and then I decide, oh, I don't know why I'm sending that out, and I'll pull it out, I'll pull it back, and I'll not send it out. I do try to send out as much of my best work as I can, and I don't simultaneously submit. If I know that the place is going to reject me pretty quickly, then I'll give them the time to do that. So I use my best judgment. I'm not just sending poems out all the time. I wait. If I know that I have a lot of stuff out there, I'll give it some time to get rejected, and come back into the fold before it goes out again. And some of it's also just how chaotic my life is. So I really haven't. I did a lot of submitting last year, and it was a pretty good year. I felt like, I hit my goal. I haven't done as much so far this year. I've just been, I've had other work that I've had to work on, or I've been tired when I came home from work, and I just haven't been in the place to do that.
Oh, definitely. Well, speaking of trying to decompress and relax a little bit, what are some of your narrative or poetic guilty pleasures, like reality TV, Breaking Bad, which is awesome? What do you kind of consume to decompress?
This is kind of, actually, you might appreciate this as a young adult guy. I've been reading, I have dipped into the Percy Jackson series, which is kind of fun. And I actually am kind of weird sometimes. I will read Charles Dickens for fun.
It's not weird. It's not, people died before the installments came out. They would push each other into the water.
Yeah, it's and again, it is. It's popular fiction. I mean, I guess it's not really that highbrow. My boyfriend and I watch Game of Thrones when that's on, and we watch Portlandia, so I think those are pretty, I'm not super into very dramatic television. I probably prefer, we've been watching Louis, which is really fun, and I really love, I'm so jealous, actually, of comedians, and I guess I sort of, I feel like as far as timing and spacing and pacing, they are the masters of that.
Oh, definitely. You could write funny poems.
I really want to. I would really like, I'd like to make that a goal of mine, to try and write funnier poems.
I think that there's a lot of humor lacking in whatever literary is. I think humor kind of gets lost sometimes.
Yeah, it can get lost. I feel like I'm much funnier, and I don't think that people think, I guess that's why when I was deciding on my author photo, I really wanted to look kind of like happy and approachable.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
And not too melodramatic, because I didn't want anyone to get the wrong idea, whatever that means.
That's an interesting thing to point out, the perception that we have, because that picture is going to be on all of the bookstores that you go to, and
I didn't want to look brooding.
Yeah, well, I mean that's the general poet picture. Like, it's in black and white, and the person looks like they're going to start stabbing a voodoo doll or something.
Yeah, maybe when I'm older.
the kind of voodoo doll stabbing picture. There you go.
Yeah.
Now you get to give some shout outs. Who are some of your primary mentors in writing?
Ooh,
you mentioned a couple. Hello, I am Kenneth Nichols, and here we are with the Great Writers Guild podcast. Today, we're going to hear from a very cool poet, Rosalind Vaz Diaz, the author of Only Blue Body from Anhinga Press. I'm going to go check that out. We had a great talk about poetry, about why we do what we do, how to revise, how to have mentors, even a little bit about how to entertain your audience when you're at a reading. Ms. Vaz Diaz made a little bit of Great Writers Guild history. She's the first poet with whom I have spoken on this podcast. So go ahead, pour yourself a color teeny, sit back, and listen to the great advice that you'll hear from her. All that and more coming up right after this. My talk with Ms. Vaz Diaz was actually a pretty interesting one for me, because, like we all do, I'm kind of going through a bit of self-doubt at the moment for a number of reasons. Ms. Vaz Diaz and I spoke about the fears that we all share as writers. How do we overcome the self-doubt that is part and parcel of being a creative person? How do we do that? And I think one of the ways is through community. And that's why I wanted to give a shout out to penbuzz.com. That's penbuzz.com. Now, it's something a little bit interesting, a little bit different. It's a social media network for writers. It's at the beginning stages, so it's not as hopping as your Facebook feed, but it's definitely worth checking out. One of the interesting things that the creator has done is to make a place where people can ask questions of each other. It's like a social media message board, but without all of the pictures of your friends' babies. I think that's a good way to put it. For example, a writer, Julia Proud, who is a writer of crime fiction, noir, I believe, she asked a question in the open forums about how we create first-person present tense. Ms. Proud writes, "How do you guys feel about first-person present tense? Do you enjoy reading books written in this style? Do you write them? Is it as difficult as it sounds? If you have experience with first-person present tense, then what are the things a writer venturing to use this style should watch out for?" I love that there's a nice, robust discussion of this question. In case you're curious what I thought, I happen to respond to her thus. I point out that it's very much a tool, just like any other point of view or style or technique available to us. I think that first-person point of view is great for suspense or crime stories because it limits the amount of information that the reader has in a natural way. A person who's investigating a crime, by nature, pretty much can't have all of the information that they'll have at the end of the investigation. So it unspools that narrative in a really realistic way. However, third-person, future tense, any kind of tense you want can create a great story of any kind. It's all about how you use it and how you measure the effect that you have on the reader. See the kind of interesting things that you get into at penbuzz.com? So I urge you to go check it out. It's free. The kind of thing the creator is trying to get something interesting and fun off the ground. So why not go check that out? That's penbuzz.com. PENBUZZ.com. Yes, I know at first I thought it was a new fountain pen site and I got all excited, but then I found it was something equally cool but different. And speaking of cool but different, let's get right into my interview with Rosalyn Vazdias. All right, we are here with Rosalyn Vazdias, author of Only Blue Body, a poetry book. It won the 2011 Robert Dana Anhinga Prize for Poetry from Anhinga Press. Hello, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I have to say that I really enjoyed your book. I'd like to hear a little bit about your journey in getting the book published and in becoming a poet.
Sure. I guess I'll start with the process and then I'll work backwards to my beginnings as a poet. The book started as my thesis project for the MFA program that I went through, Warren Wilson College. It's a low-res MFA program. So I think when it was finalized as my thesis, it was about 27 pages, I believe. They don't require you to have a book-length manuscript completed for your thesis at Warren Wilson. Some MFA programs do, but they're a little bit more flexible with that. So when I left the program in 2006, I knew that I had to get about, I guess to get to book length, maybe it was longer than 27 pages. I can't completely remember because that was, it feels like a long time ago now, which is strange. I knew that I had a decent chunk of work to work with, but it wasn't quite ready to go out the door. And I think I had a somewhat common experience coming out of an MFA program in that I was a little frozen. Like I didn't feel completely comfortable writing anymore in some ways, just writing like in a spontaneous way or a playful way. So it took me a little bit of time. I did a lot of just playing around in my notebook and journaling and kind of trying to write some work. And I was pretty nervous because I felt like I wasn't moving fast enough, like I wasn't getting my thesis out there in the world quickly enough. And then actually, I think in late 2007, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, Ross White. He's another Warren Wilson alum, and he runs Bull City Press, which is run out of North Carolina. And they do the publication Inch, and they've done some chapbooks, I think, and they also sponsor the a competition with Frost Place, a really great little chapbook competition, where they print the chapbook and you also get to spend, I think, a week or two at Frost Place. So that's an interesting little project that they have there now. But he had been doing a poem a day thing with a very small circle of people, and it was brand new at the time. And I expressed some sort of half-hearted interest in that. I was like, oh, that sounds like something I'd like to do. Kind of thinking like, oh, I would love to do that. But I probably never will, because it doesn't sound like something I'm capable of. And then the next thing you know, I was signed up for November. And I had to write a poem a day for November of 2007. And it really worked. It really got me over that hump of fear and procrastination. And then I think by early 2008, I had enough poems to kind of throw together a book-length manuscript with what I had already had and the new work. And then that was the very first draft. And I polished it over the years. So I started submitting it for the first time in spring of 2008 and submitted it for about 3 years. And I think like early 2011, I was like, I am going to get this thing taken this year. And I really I just sent it to as many contests as I could. And I revised it heavily. I cut, I think, about 7 poems and replaced them with new work that I liked a lot more. And then in November of 2011, I got an email from Anhinga asking if it was still available and letting me know that it had won this prize. So that was that little adventure. And then I think we spent about a year just, you know, editing it and putting it together. And it came out in November 2012.
Yeah, no, very cool. I'm shopping around a young adult novel, and I've sent out more queries than I'd like to admit. So it's nice to hear, you know, that you went through this kind of struggle for 3 years on the book. What got you through that time?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, what got me through it, when I started Warren Wilson, I met a poet, an older poet, who lives in L.A., and his name is Rick Bursky. He actually has his third book coming out. But of course, at the time I met him, both of us had 0 books. And we maintained our friendship. And when his first book came out, he told me that he had sent it out about 90, maybe 92 or 96, somewhere in the 90s. So I was like, okay, I have to send it out about 100 times. And then I'm going to worry after 100. So until I hit 100, I'm going to try not to stress out. And I think I didn't keep the best records when I was sending it out that time. I'm sending out a second manuscript now, and I'm trying to keep better records. But I did eventually count it up, and I think I sent it out about 70 times in that 3-year period. So, you know, and the other thing, I guess, is, you know, here and there I would be notified that I had been a finalist, or I would get like a really small encouraging note. And I was like, okay, I'm getting a little closer. And I was working on it, and I was trying to make it better, and I was trying to make it tighter. And I could see it getting better. And I think that helped, too. And it is a pretty lonely... It's kind of a lonely process. I didn't have a lot of people that I showed it to. I didn't have a group, a workshop group of any kind that I was showing it to or sharing it with. And I didn't really have any mentors that I was working with on it. But I kind of already had been through the mentor process with the MFA program. And I think to some extent you have to internalize that for the time after the MFA programs. So maybe that helped as well. And then just to address your other question, you know, I probably started writing, like a lot of poets, I started writing poetry when I was 14. And because, you know, I had some unhappy relationships. And I think that's probably, I don't know, how many poets do you think get started that way?
I think it's a lot. I did that. You know, they're all horrible. They're all thinly veiled allegories of what you went through. They're all like rock song lyrics, or, you know, at least in my case, I'm guessing it's very common.
I think it's extremely common. But I liked it. And, you know, I also knew my dad was an English teacher. So there were a lot of books around the house, and there were definitely a lot of things that would come home, like writing advice things. And, you know, what I would read is, you know, every writing teacher says that poets have to read poetry. So I started doing that kind of a little bit on my own. So I would go to my library in the high school, and I would check out books of poems, and I would like read my brother's creative writing textbook from when he started taking college classes. And that's it. And it's not like I was reading the most amazing poetry in the world or anything. I was just trying to put it together and to see what was out there. And I just kind of stuck with it. I felt like I could see my work progressing. By the time I was around 18, I was like, okay, well, I can see that my work seems better than it was when I was 14, or better than it was when I was 16. So if I keep going, the stuff I'm writing now, like what I'm going to be writing in 4 or 5 years will be better than what I'm writing right now. And then sometimes I do wonder, like, there are definitely points in my life where I'm like, why am I doing this? You know, I started doing this at a certain age and kind of naively kept doing it. And I think that it's probably kind of important to check in with yourself here and there and say, hey, do I still like this? What does it mean to me now? How do I feel about it? Like what makes me happy? I think that's just part of what you do.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely in that same place. Cause I'm just so, I want to get my book published. I'm feeling exactly the way you described. Where, you know, every few years you kind of say, like, why am I not more successful? Why am I not doing what I want to do? But I guess it's normal.
Yeah, that sounds really, really pretty normal. And to some extent, I am doing what I want to do. I think for me, like, my professional life is probably worse than my writing life. And I think my writing life is sort of what gives my life any value that I can assign it. So, and that might just be something that I tell myself so that I don't feel really depressed, you know, because it's easy to get into a place where you're like, this is meaningless and stupid, and no one cares about me. But those, I mean, that's not really true. You know, the people in my life have been really supportive. You know, the relationship that I'm in right now, my boyfriend's very supportive. My parents have always, always, always been very encouraging, which is shocking and special. You know, I think that when you're a poet, and your family's like, yeah, we think you should write poetry. That's really special. And it's not to say that they always get it or understand what the heck I'm doing. But we don't have big fights about it. You know, it's not something that they never say, well, you should give that up now.
Oh, sure.
Isn't it tough? So I think I'm fortunate in that way.
What I found interesting through the common thread of the book and through, I'm guessing, a lot of your current work, because it seems like a very personal common theme, there's a lot of animal imagery in the book. A lot of that kind of thing. Where is that a conscious thing that you're doing, or am I incorrect, or do you have a relationship with the animal kingdom that gives life to you in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up in rural PA, rural Pennsylvania, and I spent a lot of time outdoors, and I think I've always felt, you know, we had a lot of barn cats and animals around, and I think I've always felt a little closer to animals, or they were a presence in my life from early on. I don't feel like I'm addressing this in a very eloquent way.
No, it's actually perfect timing, because I hear a dog muttering and shaking its chain, so I find that perfect.
Yeah, he just wanted to put his two cents in. Animals have always been a big part of my life and a big part of my imaginative life. You know, when I was a kid, like I said, I would spend a lot of time outdoors and by myself, and, you know, I would tell myself these elaborate stories, usually involving like orphans who could talk to wolves and, you know, control, you know, like have conversations with animals and the animals would help them with things. So, and of course that's a huge thing in fairy tales and children's stories as well. So, I do often feel like I've never really, like, I guess in my ideal world, I would be a character in a children's book.
I like that way of thinking about it, because I'm thinking of at least a couple poems, Hidden and Drawing the Self-Portrait. There's an I character, and the I is at least part animal.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like something that you're imagining for yourself in some kind of connection.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I still kind of think of myself in some ways, and maybe it's even just a kind of a coping mechanism of going through life, you know, of looking at my own behavior and thinking of myself as an animal and thinking of myself, like, how I move through the world and what I'm reacting to and how I survive. And it can be kind of a fun way to look at one's existence, I think.
Oh, definitely. I wanted to talk about, because I haven't actually spoken with a poet yet in these podcasts, so I'm really interested to get inside the head of, you know, a real poet as opposed to me, who's just kind of published, you know, in some cool places. But you're an actual poet. And I wanted to know about one of the big differences, it seems to me, between poetry and prose is obviously the sound of the words on the page mimicking some kind of response in the mind, the way that you transfer sounds and meaning in a much more scattershot artistic way than you would in prose. And obviously there's no good or bad, it's just a different method of communication. So I was thinking, if you look at a poem like Mosquito in the book, on page 16, the lines, I like to write in meter, I'm not seeing that the book is written much in meter, but the lines are 6 or 7 words long, they're separated by double spacing. I'm thinking of the sound that you're trying to create, and then comparing it to something that looks a lot more prose-based. For example, that poem Night Work at Jeff's, which seems like a collection of paragraphy type lines. Can you talk at all about the sound that you have in your head when you're constructing lines that are more poetic than prose based?
Yeah, that's such a tough question. In some ways, because it really gets to the heart of like, why do you choose a more lyric way of expression, as opposed to just sitting down and writing a prose poem? I think, oh man, I love that question. I think for me, some of it is about pacing. And some of it is about control of the situation, and taking time to look at what's, I mean, particularly with this, with Mosquito, and with some of the other poems where what's in front of the speaker is confusing or appalling or terrifying. You know, she's slowing down, she's almost slowing down time. And trying to get a handle on what's happening in front of her. So I think that's where the white space and the shorter line might aid in that. And it's, you know, it's been a while. I think I might have written this poem in
Oh, sure.
2005.
It's something that I'm guessing that you still think about as you construct lines.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I don't feel as driven to write in a lyric fashion, and you know, although I still do, and I don't think of myself as being in one box or the other. I love writing really narrative poems. The one of the poems in here, I think, Only Sweetness, which I really have a fun time reading when I read it in front of people. That's a much more narrative poem, but it's also a poem where what's in front of the person who's telling us the poem is not quite clear to her. Like she's not totally sure what she's seeing, or if she, what she thinks she's seeing is quite what she's seeing. And that's a much more compact poem, I think. There's not as much white space in it. And the voice is much more narrative. And I think right now when I'm stuck, when I'm blocked, I like just writing a little prose poem. And writing in the prose line and just saying as much as I can and just being like, okay, I'm not gonna give so much significance to to individual bits of sentence. I'm just gonna blurt it, I'm just gonna vomit on the page, basically, you know, and get it out. And I think with the, I probably go back and try to make stuff more lyric now if I do that, and give it more breathing room and give it more white space and cut out unnecessary bits. You know, some of it might have been the influence of the program. Not that there was an emphasis on lyric poetry, but you could make your own plan for what you were trying to do. And I think what I was trying to do was just actually learn to write poetry in a schooled way. I had been kind of a wild child just by myself. I hadn't really been taught by anyone until I got to the MFA program. So I think there were just a lot of basics that I was missing, and I was trying to learn more about how to control a line, and what that felt like and what it meant. So, and I mean, I still love thinking about that stuff. Control in a poem is one of my favorite things to think about ever, and pacing and giving information to the reader and how we do that. It still just lights my brain on fire to think about that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because one of the things that I think about a lot is the way that, especially in poetry, you have a lot of control over the audience's perception of what you're describing and control of their experience. But I'm wondering what you think of as the balance between explaining and not explaining, the balance between being accessible and being experimental. Because I've met a lot of young people, you know, like teen, like, you know, young adults, not 3-year-olds, but they think that poetry is only, you know, fancy pantsy people getting their depressed thoughts out on paper. And like, I had someone say that once, and no, it's not
yeah.
necessarily that, and it's not necessarily, you know, random letters on a page that someone scratched out of a New York Times article. What do you think about the balance between experimenting and also trying to keep a large audience for poetry?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I'm just gonna say before I say anything that I don't know that this book would be ever considered accessible or the most accessible thing that's out there. And I guess I think that's funny in a way. I think the person that I am on the page is not totally like the person I am in life, but a little bit like her. You know, obviously there's some overlap. You know, it's probably important for young people to, if they're going to be writers, to kind of take the path that they need to take. And I think we all go through that phase of being like, well, this is what poetry is, but it's a huge world. I mean, I think there's so much room to write, whatever kind of poetry you want to write, whether you want to write very narrative poetry or very experimental poetry. I think for me, I want to have fun, and I do want the reader to be engaged and to understand to some extent what I'm saying. I mean, what's the point? We're not trying to baffle the reader. Billy Collins said something. He said something about, I don't know if this is something he said or something one of his teachers said, but if you're going to take me into a dark basement, hold my hand. And then when I was working on my thesis and putting that together at Warren Wilson, I was working with Jim Longenbach, who's a really excellent teacher, and he was all about clarity, and he just wanted me to make my poems as clear as they could possibly be. And I think it's such a blessing. I would wish a teacher like that on any writing student, because it's such a blessing to have a teacher who wants you to write clearly. That probably means something a little bit different, depending on the student. You know, maybe that just means that you're 20% less obscure than you were when you started. But it's still a huge goal. I mean, of course you don't want to alienate your reader. That's crazy. You want to keep them in the poem until the end of the poem, and you want to keep them in your book until the end of the book. And you want them to hopefully come back to you and read other work that you're going to write. I don't know if that answers that question, but I think clarity is one of the best things for a young writer to learn to have.
Yeah, no, it's a good answer. It's just something that I think about, because I worry that some of the, obviously there is poetry of all kinds going out there, but I worry that the predominant aesthetic is alienating more of the general audience than it should.
That's such a huge thing. Yeah, I don't even know how to address that. It is a worry. I don't know. I guess I just want to be optimistic, and maybe I want to lie to myself and think that somehow people will come back to poetry. I guess the other thing is, you know, if I'm reading my friend's poetry, I know everyone's like, oh, poets are only reading each other. But that actually means that we have really excellent readers of our work. So, you know, I try to be an ambassador and get people into poetry if I can. And then I just try not to let it keep me awake at night, I guess, also.
Well, I want to talk about that, because you mentioned being an ambassador, and you mentioned how some poems, the way you approach them in reading. How do you approach a poem, in reading a poem, when it's a little bit more, like, for example, the title poem, Only Blue Body, it's the way it looks on the page is clearly meaningful, but a lot of that might be lost in the reading because it's verbal. How do you approach performing poems that are less like prose or less linear?
I just try to, I do try to read the white space a little bit if I can, or try to take a little incremental pause at the end of a line. I think that can be a balancing act. And I just try to also be really engaging when I can be, and to try to be humorous between poems a little bit, because I know that when I'm reading the poems, sometimes I'll be thinking to myself, man, this is weird. Like, what the hell am I doing up here? Like, this is a weird poem. These people are probably freaked out right now. Yeah, that's pretty much all I would say about that. I'm not a big performer. I try to read pretty naturally, and I try to read in a paced way so that the words can be heard and the white space can be at least hinted toward, if not completely heard.
Well, what I love that you're saying is that, obviously, great writers steal. We're trying to steal from you. I love the idea, and I think I've thought of it before, of approaching a reading as kind of like a rock concert, where you begin with, you know, something to get the audience going. There's some nice Bruce Springsteen banner in between songs. And then, you know, you finish with a strong audience, you know, encore performance. Is that a crazy metaphor for you?
No, that's a perfect metaphor, because I always know what I'm going to read before I go into the reading. I make a little list of how I'm going to do it. And that's more for me, just because I get nervous. So I have to know what page I'm going to next. And I don't want to be standing up there shaking and trying to figure out.
Oh, I forget what page it's on. I think I don't know this one. Yeah. We've all done that. We've seen it.
Yeah, it is a little irksome to go into a reading and have the person be so casual, and you're like, you knew that this reading was happening. Like, are you really going to stand up there and page through your book and try to figure out what you're going to read to us next? Like you didn't even bother to prepare. Like that seems a little bit showy to me, and not real. So I do make sure that there's an arc. Just like putting a manuscript together, I try to give the reading an arc. And I did actually, usually I began with Hidden when I was on my Ann Hinga sponsored book tour, because I felt like it illuminated, you know, the rest of the reading. And also that poem is basically a children's exercise. The Kenneth Koch exercise, I used to be, but now I am. That's how I wrote that poem Hidden about the dogoat pirate. So I wanted to say to my audience, you know, hey, I might read you some weird poetry, but this first poem that I'm opening with, it's a children's exercise and anyone can do it. And you can do it. You can leave here and go write a poem just like this. Just using I used to be, but now I am.
If I can ask a small note about that, because how often do we get to ask a poet about his or her work? But in Hidden, you do something in the middle of the poem that I always lecture students not to do, and obviously rules are made to be broken. But I'm really curious about what you think about the sound and the meaning of that also followed by the comma in the middle of the poem. Several lines down, we got along because it was fiction. Also, there seemed little choice. What was your thought behind also? Do you see what I'm saying? Usually you wouldn't put also at the beginning of a sentence because it's kind of a weak way to get into it. You know what I mean? Like in regular prose. I'm curious about why it works to use it there.
I don't know. I mean, now that you bring that up, who knows if it does work?
Well, I'm not trying to pick on anybody.
I think I wanted the clipped sentence. That sentence, "we got along because it was fiction," isn't super clipped, but I wanted to break, you know, I break it with the line break. And I think I don't totally know why I made that choice. I think there's the speaker is pointing out that they were existing in a storybook, but they were also in great peril. So in the world of the storybook world, where these animals wouldn't normally get along, even though that's a fictional world, they're still pirates. So they still, if they get captured, they're still going to be punished. I don't think I've ever like talked it out like this before, so it sounds even worse, even sadder in a way, putting it
No,
that
it
way.
sounds great. How often do we hear, you know, a poet thinking about their lines in the fashion that we are?
I can't tell you much about the construction. I must have liked, I think maybe I liked the hardness of it. And that's probably all I can say about that. If you know what I mean by hard, like the kind of the hardness
Yeah,
of it.
it's a transitional word, and it occurs in the middle of the line after the previous sentence. So I can definitely see how it serves as a transition and lends meaning to what comes after that, which is also broken up by the colon there. So I can definitely see that. I'm just curious, you know, because it's we make a billion choices, especially when we write a poem or lyric poetry or, you know, things that are not prose. And it seems to me, so many more variables than when you're writing regular prose.
Yeah, there are a ton of variables, and we've been talking a lot already about young writers, and I'll just go back and say this, because I think it's a pretty common way of thinking when you're a beginning poet. You know, you start writing poetry as a kid, or as a juvenile, as a teenager, and you think, oh man, this is so much better than writing essays. There aren't any
It's
rules.
shorter.
I'm just gonna do whatever I want. And then if you keep going as a poet, you realize that there are so many rules that they can actually kind of crush you. But by that time, the rules become comforting. And they become somehow better. You know, there you realize how hard it is and how many ways you can screw up. And I guess that just gives you a lot of freedom to kind of keep doing it and keep trying it. And there are so many choices that you have to make, and there probably are places that you're going to make the wrong choice. It's hard for me to think about each. I don't know that I've ever written a poem where each line was exactly perfect as a line. And I know some people who work that way, and I find it pretty astonishing. And if they can do that, I think it's really great. But I don't know if I've ever been that much of a craftsperson that I could do that.
Well, there's plenty of time in the future. That's why we keep doing
Yeah, I figure,
it.
you know, I have until I die, so I'm not you know, I'm gonna just keep trying till then,
Well,
right?
that's why writing is so great. You mentioned earlier that since you're speaking about yourself, that the person on the page is different from you, which is true for every author, but what do you think is the difference between you and the I, or the me in the poems that you create?
Well, the first difference is that my life is so dull. And they get to have these kind of rich adventures where, you know, they could something in front of them could transform into something completely different. And, you know, I can kind of edit out the dullness of my life. The person on the page that is still the part of me is definitely a crafted and an edited character. So I guess it's kind of like if you were a color and you were being cooked down into a pigment, or, you know, if you were a harvested pigment and you were being concentrated somehow, that must be a really exciting experience to be the most concentrated form of pigment that you can be. And then I guess you're diluted and made into a painting, but that experience of being compressed into this pure pigment must feel really amazing. And I think that's probably what the difference between the poet who's walking around in real life and the poet who's existing in the poems.
I love that way of thinking about it, because I'm a fountain pen person, and if you can add a couple drops of water to a bottle of ink to make the color a little bit calmer. You can, you know, don't concentrate it to make sure the colors are a little bit more striking, and so I love that way of thinking about it, because it's the same bottle of ink, but if you take water out or put it in, you get a slightly different hue and slightly different performance in the ink.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I love that. I didn't ask you beforehand. Usually I do, but I'm guessing that you have an indie fun bookstore type place that you'd like to give a shout out to.
Oh, absolutely. There's actually a ton of them in Providence. There's a great one on the west end of Providence, Ada Books, and they run some reading series out of there. There's a series run out of there called Publicly Complex, which is very good if you're in Providence. You can catch some readings there sometimes, and that's a great place to visit. There's a great used bookstore downtown called Seller Stories, which is a really fun, fantastic, jammed with books bookstore. There's another place downtown that sells a lot of academic and art books that are kind of they're not remaindered, but they might be like sort of extras. Maybe they didn't sell that well to begin with, so they're sold at a little bit of a markdown, and you can get some really fabulous critical work and art books and literature there. It's called Symposium Books. So those are three right off the top of my head that you should definitely visit if you're in Providence sometime.
Very cool, very cool. I used to live on Cape Cod, so I would go through Providence.
Yeah, to get to almost anywhere, not anywhere in New England.
Lots of places, yeah.
Providence is right there on 95. It's a nice little place to visit for the day. Although Cape Cod is, Cape Cod's pretty beautiful.
I liked being 5 minutes away from a beach. No matter where you are, you're that close to a beach.
Yeah, it's amazing out there. It's really beautiful.
But Providence is also a nice place. It is, because you're so close to water, you're close to Connecticut.
Pretty industrial here. Yeah, actually, we were just down at our public library today. They were having an indie press expo. So there was every kind of person who's ever made a little chapbook or a little comic book or a little print, and it was astonishing. It was so great. Everyone was sitting at their table hawking their wares and, like, scribbling with their little pens and making cute and funky stuff, and it was a really great day.
I just wish that the world could have more cute and funky indie publishing get-togethers and fewer Kardashians. We need that.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you.
So there are a few questions that I ask everybody, and we're curious because we don't really talk about them very much with other writers. But what does your revision procedure generally look like?
I'm pretty bad at revising. I think because of the same sort of tension that I was talking about earlier. So I kind of got over my tension around just sitting down and drafting stuff. I've gotten over that to some extent. And that fear has kind of moved on to revision. But what I try to do is kind of look, if I'm looking at the poem, at a draft of a poem, I try to figure out, like, what is the most important thing that I'm trying to talk about in this poem? Like, what am I trying to say? Or what matters to me the most? Or did I inadvertently say something in this poem that is the most true part of it? So I think that's the place. You look for that place and you identify it. And then usually what I do is kind of start with a blank page. And I try to kind of rewrite the same poem using that kind of core heartbeat as the jumping off place, or I write to that place. And what I've been trying to do a little bit lately is if I have an idea and I write one poem about it or to it, and I'm not happy with it, I just rewrite it until I get something better. So I won't necessarily discard the material, you know. So some of it's just trying to figure out what I want to write about or what's most important to me at that moment. And then I just write about that every day until I feel like I have something that I can work with. So although that's not technically revision, it kind of can feel like it because you just kind of pretend you're writing the same poem every day. And then sometimes if that works, you might get more than one decent poem about this thing that you're so preoccupied with. So I think that that's not a bad way to work. You know, because if you fail at something once, that doesn't mean that you've failed at it forever. And, you know, I mean, who goes to run around a track, and if they don't run, you know, the perfect time right away, they just give up? Like, that, we don't do that. So we shouldn't do that with our writing either.
Very cool. When you're working on that, it's obviously maybe a little different from poetry to prose between those people. But how do you compose? I like to use a fountain pen. I don't have special notebooks, but, you know, I have ones I like better than others. But how do you generally start putting down lines?
Well, I do actually do just a lot of straight typing right now. But I do use a notebook and like a ballpoint pen. And I'll just sort of play around with that. And again, it doesn't have to be a special notebook. I try to keep it pretty cheap, because I don't want to be afraid to write in what I have to write in. So I don't want to have something that I feel is too exalted for me to, like, put my crappy words into.
Dollar store. You can get great journals at the dollar store.
Exactly. So you just want something that isn't going to make you feel like it's not like you're not good enough for it.
It's like when you get a birthday gift. I've gotten you this leather-bound journal full of pages of this beautiful paper.
I know, it's the scariest thing in the world. You're like, I can't write in that.
Whereas I've gotten great journals at the dollar store that I've written novels in. I wrote my young adult novel in a dollar notebook that I thought the character might use. Yeah.
Nice. Oh, I love that.
It has that lenticular cover. It's all purple. And is it flowery? Is it? Oh yeah, butterflies, and it's the kind of thing that I pictured my character writing in. So I wrote the whole book inside that little journal.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Very cool. Once you have poems where you said when you're happy with them, what's your general procedure in terms of submission? What's your philosophy?
My philosophy. I try to submit a lot. And I try to submit, I don't know, like once or I guess what, anywhere from once to four times a year, I'll try to sit down, just with individual poems, and I'll try to do as many packets at a time as I can. So I generally send out three poems together, and you know, if I get out 15 to 25 packets of three poems, like once a quarter, or you know, probably once a quarter, that's a pretty good year. Although my number, I guess I don't know if, I guess that's an ideal. I'm not sure if, I think I generally, if I can do 50 packets a year, that's pretty decent. So it's probably more like not every quarter. I just have to keep work out there because I get a ton of rejections. Before the book came out, I was averaging one acceptance a year. So a lot of people will, you know, obviously we all talk a lot about do you simultaneously submit or do you not? And I hope no one's actually listening to this because I am going to say that I do simultaneously submit, but that's just because my acceptance rate is so low that I really haven't had to deal with having a poem that two places
Who
want.
doesn't send out simultaneously?
Yeah, it's, I think it's a necessary evil. Yeah, I try to get stuff out there, and sometimes I'll you know, I do send stuff out, and then I decide, oh, I don't know why I'm sending that out, and I'll pull it out, I'll pull it back, and I'll not send it out. I do try to send out as much of my best work as I can, and I don't simultaneously submit. You know, if I know that the place is going to reject me pretty quickly, then I'll give them the time to do that. So I use my best judgment. All you know, I'm not just sending poems out all the time. I wait. You know, if I know that I have a lot of stuff out there, I'll give it some time to get rejected. And come back into the fold before it goes out again. And some of it's also just how chaotic my life is. So, I really haven't, I did a lot of submitting last year and it was a pretty good year. I felt like, I hit my goal. I haven't done as much so far this year. I've just been, I've had other work that I've had to work on, or I've been tired when I came home from work, and I just haven't been in the place to do
Oh,
that.
definitely. Well, speaking of trying to decompress and relax a little bit, what are some of your narrative or poetic guilty pleasures, like reality TV, Breaking Bad, which is awesome? What do you kind of consume to decompress?
This is kind of, actually, you might appreciate this as a young adult, as a young adult guy. I've been reading, I have dipped into the Percy Jackson series, which is kind of fun. And I actually am kind of weird sometimes. I will read Charles Dickens for
That's
fun.
not weird. It's not, people died before the installments came out. They would push each other into the water.
Yeah, it's and again, it is, it's popular fiction. I mean, I guess it's not really that highbrow. My boyfriend and I watch Game of Thrones when that's on. And we watch Portlandia. So I think those are pretty, I'm not super into very dramatic television. I probably prefer, we've been watching Louie, which is really fun, and I really love, I'm so jealous actually of comedians And I guess I sort of, I feel like as far as timing and spacing and pacing, they are the masters of
Oh,
that.
definitely. You could write funny poems.
I really want to. I would really like, I'd like to make that a goal of mine, to try and write funnier poems.
I think that there's a lot of humor lacking in whatever literary is. I think humor kind of gets lost sometimes.
It can get lost. I feel like I'm much funnier, and I don't think that people think. I guess that's why when I was deciding on my author photo, I really wanted to look kind of like happy and
Yeah, I
approachable
can see that, yeah.
and not too melodramatic, because I didn't want anyone to get the wrong idea, whatever that
That's an
means.
interesting thing to point out, the perception that we have, because that picture's going to be on all of the bookstores that you go to, and
I didn't want to look brooding.
yeah, well, I mean that, yeah, that's the general poet picture, like it's in black and white and the person looks like they're going to start stabbing a voodoo doll or something.
Yeah, maybe when I'm older.
the kind of voodoo doll stabbing picture. There you go.
Yeah.
Now you get to give some shout-outs. Who are some of your primary mentors in writing?
Oh,
You mentioned a couple.
yeah, well, I had four great teachers at Warren Wilson. Dana Levin, who's really spectacular, A. Van Jordan, Karen Brennan, and Jim Longenbach, and they were all extremely generous with their time and with their wisdom. I have some great friends who I did already mention: Rick Bersky, Ross White, have been really pretty inspirational to me as far as their work ethic and their drive and their enthusiasm. And just their general kind of
Joie de
de
vivre.
voir. So, thank you. I'm not a scholar,
I took German,
obviously.
so I don't know much French, but I know that one, I think.
Yeah, and people that I haven't met but who I really admire. I really love the work of Bridget, Peggy, and Kelly. I love. I was really into Louise Glück for a while, which is probably isn't going to shock anyone. I one of the first poets that I ever loved, contemporary poets that I ever loved, was Charles
Oh,
Simic.
sure, yeah.
His work is really great, of course. And I mean, those are just some of the big names. I don't know. Just read everything. Read as much as you
I
can.
haven't asked this before, but it occurs to me for some reason. If you could be published in any journal in which you haven't appeared yet, what would that journal be?
That's easy. I've been trying to get into Plowshares for
Me too,
years.
me too. It's not easy, is
Yeah,
it?
it's not easy. It's actually kind of helpful. I wrote something that I thought, I'm like, this is the best thing I've written to date, and I sent it to them, and they rejected it. And I kind of felt like it was that I needed that, like that I then felt like, okay, so this poem is just like every other poem. It's going to take as much time. It's going to have to go out there and fight its battles. And even if I think it's really good, it could probably get better. And it's just going to have to do its thing. It's going to have to be on the circuit with all the rest of the poems, and it's just going to be out there. So it was actually kind of, I think you need that journal in your life. That's your high bar, and you send them your best work, and they don't take it. And then you come back down to earth and you're like, okay, I'll send it out some more. I'm ready for the long haul.
Very cool.
Very cool.
So obviously the most important question is, what should we look for next?
God willing, I have two little projects that I'm working on. I have a full-length manuscript that I've been doing a little bit of work on. But I think that'll take a while. I started sending it out last February, but I'm kind of in the place right now where I want to sit on it some more. So I'm not even sure if I'm going to send it out much. I think it needs a bit more work. And it's called, right now its working title is Light House. And there's a symbol called the triple bar between the words light and house. And the triple bar is a mathematical symbol that means identical to. Basically just saying, light equals living, like light equals your home. And then there's a little, project that I have, which is about which seems to be about a woman who's maybe trapped in another dimension where there aren't any other people. And she has a kind of a relationship with an Oriole that may, a sort of imaginary relationship with an Oriole. And right now that has the working title Sweet Herald, and that's a chapbook length project, and I'm sending that out very slowly as well, and still refining it. So those are the two things that I'm kind of working on, and then I'm just, you know, those are the things that are being submitted, and then I'm just drafting some other stuff and playing around. But those are the things that are kind of at the beginning of being realized, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, very cool. Well, I really liked your work a lot. I think that you're a poet who kind of threads that needle between playing around, being experimental, and also being something that is accessible by a larger percentage of the population, which is, you know, something I focus on. So I hope everybody goes out there and gets Only Blue Body from Roslyn Vazdias. You can get that from Anhinga Press, and you will see links in all of the assorted internet places where you're viewing this. And so, again, Ms. Vazdias, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. It was such a good time.
See, wasn't she an interesting person and an interesting poet? I think we should all take on her challenge to write a poem every day. I think we should do what she does in sharing our work with graphic artists and other creative people. I think that we should all have her perseverance. I mean, it's not easy to send our things out over and over and over again, but it's necessary, especially in the kind of cultural climate we have today. So many thanks to Ms. Vazdias for being so inspirational and for helping me on a personal level feel a little bit better about where I am in my personal journey. Hopefully she helps you with yours. That's all the time we have right now. Remember, I'm Kenneth Nichols for Great Writers Steal. Shakespeare did it. So should you.